We have about 10 minutes before Dr. Krishna Chandra will begin the second surgery. So let's take a look at the disease he'll be removing. Look at Bhaktivinoda Thakur 14. The Brahmanas performing yajna represent indifference to Krishna Bhakti caused by over-identification with duties of anashram or absorption in activities of karma kanda. Now the thing that I want to deal with here is indifference to Krishna Bhakti caused by over-identification with the duties of anashram dharma. So I sort of feel that we have to be careful about this, because we may say, well, this doesn't really concern me, I'm not involved with anashram. But are there ever times when you say, I've got things I have to do. I don't have time for reading. I don't have time for chanting. You know, I've got my kids to take care of. You know, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. So this is a over-preoccupation also. We're thinking, these are my duties. They take preference. We always have to remember that there's conditional response, you know, duties, and there's constitutional. And we have to keep an awareness that the primary is the constitutional. I'm Krishna's servant. And my prime business is that. And so we have to always remember, okay, let's see. And actually, Prabhupada says something very interesting in this Leela. He says that if one does not develop Krishna consciousness, all discharge of religious duties is simply a waste of time and energy. So you can be doing all your duties very, very faithfully, very, very wonderfully, but if you're not developing your Krishna consciousness alongside of doing that, then all that other stuff is simply a waste of time and energy. So very important to keep this balance that, okay, I've got these responsibilities, I should deal with them, you know, I should take the responsibility. But at the same time, my primary responsibility is to become Krishna conscious, to fulfill my, you know, mission, my life's mission. So I just thought to raise that, because I think it's a very important thing that we have to look at.
Is there any chance that one can go the other way around?
Is there any chance there?
That it can be, means disbalanced on the other. Is there any danger if someone doesn't do any other duties and only reads and chants?
If they're acting according to their arika and they don't do other duties, that's their glory. But if they artificially give up other duties on the pretense of practicing Krishna consciousness, then that's not a good thing.
That's a pretender then.
But how can you yourself know?
Well, just by your attachment. When it gets to the point where you've got more interested, like your Gumaraj, if you've got more interested in reading Bhagavatam than eating and sleeping, then we can understand that all other duties are being taken care of. And I remember the father of Bablu, he was so absorbed in chanting, he was just always chanting. And he didn't even, you know, it wasn't a preoccupation for him even to keep his room clean. There was layers of dust everywhere all through his room. But he just wasn't concerned with it. He was just absorbed in them, and that was what life was about for him. So somebody on that platform, obviously all other duties are taken care of. But if somebody is thinking, well, you know, I've had enough of this Grihastha ashram, you know, I think I'll do something else, you know. And they do it in the name of Krishna consciousness, then that's probably not a good idea. Definitely not a good idea. It's a whimsical decision like that. But if it's a spontaneous attraction to Krishna consciousness, that's a different thing. And that will gradually, if you have some kind of commitment to hearing and chanting, that taste will gradually develop. But it'll come to the point where you just can't be bothered with anything else. It's just not important anymore. Like that. But it's not something you can do artificially. Is that okay? Okay. So I wanted to talk about it in terms of anashram, because it's a hot topic in ISKCON at the moment, and I feel that we need to be very, very clear about our position on it, in terms of us as members of Mahaprabhu's mission, and in terms of us as members of Prabhupada's mission. We need to be very, very aware of that. So it's an interesting conversation that took place between Mahaprabhu and the Tapavadis when he was on his South Indian tour. Very, very interesting. I'll just read it through with you. At first I won't read Prabhupada's purport, which is in italics. We'll go back and read that afterwards. But I just want you to catch the flow of the discussion first. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu could understand that the Tapavadis were very proud of their Vaishnavism. He therefore smiled and began to speak to them. The chief acharya of the Tapavad community was very learned in the revealed scriptures. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu humbly questioned him. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "I do not know very well the aim of life and how to achieve it. Please tell me of the best ideal for humanity and how to attain it." The acharya replied, "When the activities of the four castes and the four ashrams are dedicated to Krishna, they constitute the best means whereby one can attain the highest goal of life. When one dedicates the duties of an ashram dham to Krishna, he is eligible for five kinds of liberation. Thus he is transferred to the spiritual world of Vaikuntha. This is the highest goal of life in the verdict of all revealed scriptures." Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "According to the verdict of the Shastras, the process of hearing and chanting is the best means to attain loving service to Krishna. This process entails hearing, chanting, and remembering the holy name, form, qualities, pastimes, and entourage of the Lord, offering service according to time, place, and performer, worshipping the deity, offering prayers, always considering oneself the eternal servant of Krishna, making friends with him, and dedicating everything unto him. These nine items of devotional service, when directly offered to Krishna, constitute the highest attainment of life. This is the verdict of the revealed scriptures. When one comes to the platform of loving service to Lord Krishna, by executing these nine processes, beginning with hearing and chanting, he has attained the fifth platform of success and the limit of life's goals. In every revealed scripture, there is condemnation of fruitive activities. It is advised everywhere to give up engagement in fruitive activities, for no one can attain the highest goal of life, love of Godhead, by executing them. Occupational duties are described in the religious principles. If one analyzes them, he can fully understand their qualities and faults and then give them up completely to render service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A person who does so is considered a first-class man. Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear." Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "Both the fruitive worker and the speculative philosopher are considered non-devotees. We see both elements present in your Sampradaya. The only qualification that I see in your Sampradaya is that you accept the form of the Lord as truth." Thus Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu broke the pride of the Tapavadis to pieces. Now I want to go back and read Prabhupada's purports, because they're very illuminating and they put things in a very clear perspective for us. According to the Tapavadis, the best process for achieving the highest goal of life is to execute the duties of the four varnas and ashrams. In the material world, unless one is situated in one of the varnas, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Sudra, one cannot manage social affairs properly to attain the ultimate goal. One also has to follow the principles of the ashrams, Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas, since these principles are considered essential for the attainment of the highest goal. In this way, the Tapavadis establish that the execution of the principles of Varna and Ashram for the sake of Krishna is the best way to attain the topmost goal. The Tapavadis thus establish their principles in terms of human society. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, however, differed when he said that the best process is hearing and chanting about Lord Vishnu. According to the Tapavadis, the highest goal is to return home back to Godhead. But in Sri Caitanya Mahaprabhu's opinion, the highest goal is attaining love of Godhead in either the material world or the spiritual world. In the material world, this is practiced according to Shastric injunction, and in the spiritual world, the real achievement is already there. So some very, very interesting points here that he's making. Is there any questions on this? Anything you want clarified? Or it's okay? So we're seeing here that they're thinking that Varnashram is the goal. We have to remember that we're talking about over-attachment to Varnashram. We're not saying that Varnashram is an anatta. If we look at both Gaur Lila and Krishna Lila, they both use Varnashram as a backdrop. And we're talking the two Lila, so it certainly has its place. And the process is given by Krishna. It's made very clear in Bhagavad Gita. But what we're looking at here is a confusion where they think it's actually the goal and they think Vaikuntha is the goal. But Mahaprabhu is saying, no, wait a minute. The process that you're using is not the appropriate process to attain the ultimate goal. And you need to have a look at what the actual goal is. It's Prem, Krishna Prem. Let's have a look at the
Pokarana. But that doesn't mean Mahaprabhu saying that it should be neglected and
then, no? No, he lived it. Mahaprabhu himself lived it. He lived it very strictly. He lived it strictly as a Grihastha Brahmin, and he lived it very strictly as a sannyasi. But what we're talking about here is getting a very clear idea of the place of it.
Like you said, over-attachment is not good, or giving too much importance to that is not good.
To the expense of the goal.
But just to ignore it is also not
a fact. Actually, it's a fact. In fact, even though Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta says what he tells, you'll read soon, they make it very clear that it's not something that can be affected, socially on a wide scale in Kali Yuga. But the beauty of the system, because it's a transcendental system in the sense that it's given by Krishna, is that we as individuals can assess our circumstance and use the principles of it to put ourselves in a very safe and sure situation for practicing Krishna consciousness. For example, in my situation, I'm a Brahmani and I'm a renunciate. I overly identify with those things. But if I use the culture of being a Brahmani, of being a renunciate, and I allow myself and my life to be shaped by those principles, then I'm in a very good situation to do my bhajan, to practice my Krishna consciousness. There won't be any disruption, unnecessary disruption. And we see that, where people are too... they're not so careful about this, especially our sannyasis. They don't follow their dharma so strictly. For whatever reason, it's a very high fall down rate. It's not the place of a sannyasi to counsel an emotionally disturbed woman. We've lost a number of men because of that. So, although we don't overstress it, and it's certainly not got anything to do with our goal, because it's Krishna-given, we can understand it is valuable, and it's given as an aid to our Krishna consciousness. And if we use it individually, we make an honest assessment of where we are in terms of the varnas, where we are in the terms of the ashrams. We do a bit of research on what that means, and we try and live it, it makes life very simple. You don't have to worry so much about the externals. What do I do in this circumstance? What do I do in that circumstance? We've got a format that we follow and it just falls into place. Does that make sense? So let's have a look at this second purport by Srila Prabhupada on the second page. Everyone is after success in religion, economic development, sense gratification, ultimately merging into the existence of Brahman. These are the general practices of the common man. But according to the strict principles of the Vedas, the highest attainment is to rise to the platform of Shravanam Kirtanam, hearing and chanting about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. According to Sridhar Swami, the material conception of success, moksha or liberation, is desired by those in material existence. Devotees, however, not being situated in material existence, have no desire for liberation. A devotee is always liberated in all stages of life because he is always situated in 9 items of devotional service, Shravanam, Kirtanam, etc. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy holds that devotional service to Krishna always exists in everyone's heart. It simply has to be awakened by the process of Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu. When a person is actually engaged in devotional service, his eternal relationship with the Lord, the servant-master relationship, is awakened. So Prabhupada is making it very clear that for us, we're not really so interested in liberation, we're interested in Shravanam, Kirtanam, and that will take care of things very nicely for us. Any questions on that?
I just remembered that here it says, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, according to the verdict of the Shastras, the process of hearing and chanting is the best means to attain loving service to Krishna. Mm-hmm. We have heard this, and sometimes we see a lot of emphasis on service. So here Mahaprabhu is talking about hearing and chanting. What I understand from this is that if you're doing good hearing and good chanting, you would obviously do service. That's part of the whole thing, and Prabhupada has told us. But that's not the prime goal here, what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying. He's saying hearing and chanting is the prime goal. So is that true? Can we?
Hearing and chanting is service. If you're talking pure devotional service, it starts with hearing and chanting. And obviously, we have to take into consideration that we're part of Prabhupada's Sankirtan mission. So if we have intelligence, we'll understand, okay, the preoccupation is Shravanam Kirtanam. I have a responsibility to in some way serve the Prabhupada's preaching mission. He has been so compassionate to me, I should show some compassion to others. So I should preach, or I should teach, or I should counsel, so that we are, if you're a preacher, then what is life about? It's about Shravanam Kirtanam. So the best occupation for somebody who's serious in Krishna consciousness is to preach, because you're always talking about Krishna. And, it's actually, Krishna reciprocates with that very strongly. Prabhupada reciprocates with that very strongly. So it's not that we make an either-or, but we find a way in which we can do both.
Yeah, so it's like all three are part. Shravanam, Kirtanam, and preaching. It's a whole.
Like that. That's the ideal circumstance. If you can do that, then everything's taken care of. Anything else on that? Okay, I wanted to read you something that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says about Vanashram. I always like to see what his perspective is. He's such a revolutionary. It's interesting that he says that defects will be inevitable in Vanashram because it's a system meant to regulate imperfection. So by its very nature, there will be defects in it. This secular arrangement, Vanashram Dharma, is not recommended by the scriptures as constituting the ideal social arrangement. On the contrary, it is declared to be a necessary evil to have a system of this kind in the degenerate state in which the society has fallen. This is a very important point, and one, if its significance is at all grasped, should be able to save us from the much parochial enthusiasm that has been quite wrongly wasted upon the Varnashram arrangement by its mechanical admirers. It is explicitly declared by the scriptures, if the theistic disposition is general, there can only be one class in society. The system of one class had actually prevailed formerly when people had been generally theistic by disposition. With the appearance of open atheism arose the necessity of establishing the secular gradations of society. It is a defective provision against the outbreak of barbarianism, a tendency which is due to the weakening of the theistic instinct. So it's quite amazing, you know, that if you've got such a yuga and everybody's, you know, swan-like, and everybody's absorbed in Krishna.
Like Satya Yuga, maybe.
Yeah, so why you need Vanashram? And he's saying that when these atheistic tendencies creep in, to protect it a little bit from barbarianism, then you have to impose some social structure. So that's an interesting insight that he's saying like this. I also wanted to have a look at what Prabhupada has to say. He has many things to say, but I find this particularly relevant to our discussion. This is actually from the teachings of Lord Kapila. And he's basically saying here, let's read it. In Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says that every man can become perfect by following his qualities as work. By worship of the Lord, who is the source of all living beings, and who is all-pervading, man can, in the performance of his own duty, attain perfection. Thus, if one executes his duties as a perfect kshatriya, vaisya, shudra, whatever, Vishnu will be pleased. The purpose of work is to please Vishnu. Unfortunately, people have forgotten this. Vanashram Dharma, the Vedic system of society, is therefore very important in that it is meant to give human beings a chance to perfect their lives by pleasing Krishna. Unfortunately, the Vanashram Dharma has been lost in this age. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, just to give relief to the rotting conditioned souls of this age of Kali, has given us the Maha Mantra. In this age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the only means of deliverance is chanting the holy name of the Lord. There is no other way, there is no other way, there is no other way. Although we may try to revive the perfect Vanashram system, it is not possible in this age. People are fallen, disturbed, and unfortunate. O learned one, in this iron age of Kali, men have but short lives. They are quarrelsome, lazy, misguided, unlucky, and above all, always disturbed. In this age, there will be insufficient rainfall and food, and the government will plunder one's income by heavy taxation. All of these characteristics of Kali Yuga are described in Srimad Bhagavatam. People will become so disgusted that they will suddenly leave their wife and children and go to the forest. How can the peaceful Vanashram Dharma be revived if people are so harassed in this age? It is virtually impossible. Therefore, the system of Bhakti Yoga, the chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, should be adopted. The whole aim of Bhakti Yoga is to satisfy Vishnu. Vishnu, Krishna, came himself as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to teach us the way of Sankirtan. So it's really putting it in an amazing nutshell, the emphasis. Another interesting thing that I wanted to read, it's on the same handout, from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the Gaudiya Mada's message and activities. There is no other Dharma of the Jiva except Kirtan, singing of God's names. To the extent one disbelieves in bhakti as donated by Kirtan or the holy name, in other words, those who think that all wants cannot be fulfilled by Kirtan, to that extent people are naistika. The degree of help one gives towards propagating bhakti as denoted by kirtan is the sole measure of one's belief in God. On the other hand, a man is a naistika, disbeliever, to the extent that he obstructs kirtan. As the name has to be taken at every moment, even while eating or sleeping, as bhakti denoted by kirtan is the only dharma of the jiva, as there is no other dharma except this, where is the time for alleviating flood or famine or founding hospitals? All efforts except Hare Kirtan are the cause of samsara, this worldly sojourn, the road leading not to the east but in the opposite direction. On the other hand, continual performance of Hare Kirtan is the turning away from every other direction to face east, or the journey homeward. The Gaudiya Math is the mission of this constant kirtan. It's an amazing statement. So the more you hear from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the more you understand Prabhupada's perspective. He's taken, obviously, he's very much absorbed in his Guru Maharaj's mood. Okay. So it looks from what we're reading that Nam Sankirtan is the Yugadharma, not Varnashram. And that's very logical. There's a lot of logical and practical reasons for that. Any questions or comments on what we've been talking about?
I really find it very interesting that, you know, Prabhupada mentions that in this age it is not really possible to have Varnashram as it is because nothing's working the way it should. So I really find it very interesting that when Prabhupada is saying that, then we should really not focus our energies into that.
True. That's very true. We can take advantage of it as a system, but to try and globally or socially implement it, wouldn't that be a diversion of our energy?
Well, I mean, it is helpful at least that much. You taught us that you know what are your duties in your ashram, otherwise you cause disturbance and you
disturb. Yeah.
And then
that aspect of it we can learn valuable lessons from. But what we're talking here is trying to implement it en masse in this age. It's just not a feasible proposition.
Doing for oneself, you know, is one thing, but implementing it as a process takes a lot of energy and time of the society. So that is what the point is, that, you know, we are not going to be officially implementing it, spending time and energy trying to perfect that situation. In our own lives, we know what kind of Varnashram dharma we should follow, and we should follow it.
Yeah.
So, as a formal situation, it's
not
worth spending time.
But then some people say Prabhupada said that when he left, he said, I finished only half my work, and I wanted to introduce Varnashram as well.
But you have to look at the context in which he said that. There are senior men who disagree with that out of context representation of Prabhupada's statement. There are, you know, people who are in, you know, responsible and high position who don't agree that that's what Prabhupada meant. But they saw it as the 50% left to be done means that we should be vigorously preaching Mahaprabhu's mission. So we have to always look at things in context. Otherwise things, you know, can get a little bit bent out of shape. Might become another Prabhupada said.
Yes.
But when you look at human life and you look at how much we have to deal with in a day, do we really want to divert our attention from the main process and the main goal? Do we really want to do that? This is a fundamental question. Is that making sense? Want to say something else?
No, I mean, I agree that that cannot be their main focus, but some culture has to be there as well.
Oh yeah, and definitely it's the best cultural background. Otherwise, why did Mahaprabhu and Krishna use it for the Nityalila? It's obviously the best cultural background, but you can't expect to, you know, be able to put it into full effect in this age. I mean, India is a little bit saner, still a little bit saner than the West. You know, like you can still see a semblance of the. Of the Varnas in particular, but you don't see them anywhere else in the world. How are you going to impose these four, you know, ashrams and Varnas on people that have no idea of this kind of stuff? It would be difficult even in India. But I agree with your point that there has to be some cultural setting. But I think that, you know, that cultural setting, more appropriately in Kali Yuga, will be the culture of Bhagavatam. Otherwise, Mahabharata, why did he give that culture? He lived it. Mahabharata Lila is basically Bhagavatam lived. Yeah. So, is it okay? Still like you feel like so it looks like you still got a question. We're not talking good or bad, we're talking emphasis. If there's an overemphasis, it will be a disturbance. If there's an overemphasis, there's a good possibility that we'll forget the goal. And we'll be sidetracked from the process that leads to that goal. So this is what we're talking about here. Is it okay? So it looks like we're ready for our second surgery for today. Let's discuss Krishna book first. Anybody have any thoughts on this?
Actually, this Leela had lots of things.
Yes, I also found the same thing that, boy, this one's really full of stuff. Yeah. Share something with us of what you found.
I'm just thinking which one to share for 1 second. Okay, I'll share this point, which I found it very interesting that Krishna tells the boys that don't get disappointed, go back. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that was so interesting for a practicing devotee, because, you know, sometimes in your personal bhajan you get disappointed that, you know, things are not working out the way they should, or when you're preaching, then it's not working out. When you're doing a book distribution, it's not working out. So I thought this was a very nice message that, you know, Krishna sends those boys, go back. So if, even for me, like personally, it's just go back, do it again. Mm-hmm. It's not like you just like get disappointed and one time it doesn't work.
That's a good point.
So,
anything else?
Krishna knew that they will not leave, no?
Yeah.
But he still sent them to both, because if they wouldn't have asked with Ramanas first, then they wouldn't have felt so bad after.
Yeah.
I mean, then their appreciation would have been less, no?
But I saw it from another point of view also. The question that came to my mind is, why did he bother going to the Brahmins? Why did he do that? But then I thought, because he's a brilliant strategist, if he sent the boys directly to the Brahmins' wives, it would have been a scandal. Because then, you know, they're pure lovers of Krishna, they would have gone. They would have gone against all social codes and gone. And then it would have been a nightmare. The whole situation would have been a real disaster. But because of the way he did it, he went to the Brahmins, they refused. Then he goes to the wives, they don't refuse. And then there's a whole learning experience for the husbands, and so many things go on. But if, you know, he's just so brilliant with the way his sense of strategy. That's what struck me, that, you know, he could have, why didn't he just go and sit down, you know, why didn't he take everybody to their place and sit down and have a meal? Why didn't he do that? So he's, you know, he's very concerned to draw out the relationship, draw out the rasa.
I'm sure the contrast also to us, so we understand, you know, what is ritualism and what is love for Godhead.
Yeah, that's a very nice point. Yeah. Yeah. Did you have anything to say? Yes?
No.
Okay. Another thing that I wanted to share, which really struck me, was Prabhupada, he gives an amazingly simple explanation of the process of surrender. It really, really struck me. It's in his preaching section of the story. Everyone is loving himself according to the advancement of his knowledge. Ultimately, when a person comes to understand that his self is spirit soul, and the spirit soul is nothing but a part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, he recognizes the Supreme Lord as the ultimate goal of love, and then surrenders unto him. This surrender is considered auspicious for the conditioned soul. Our life, property, home, wife, children, house, country, society, and all paraphernalia, which are very dear to Krishna, are expansions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Mm. He is the central object of love because he gives us all bliss, expanding himself in so many ways according to our different situations, namely bodily, mental, or spiritual. So amazing. I mean, it's just, he's everything. He's the property, he's the, you know, the family, he's the body, he's everything. And he expands himself like that so that we can actually come to love him. We can see through it. It's just an amazing definition of surrender.
Yeah.
Very good,
sir. Another point was, I remembered from this seminar that Madhavanand Prabhu had done last year in Goa then. Prabhupada mentions it, and he had explained this point very beautifully. Prabhupada mentions that the wives had heard about Krishna and Balaram, whereas the brahmanas hadn't. So it just like in the case of that washerman, you know, hearing is so important. And so I was really struck by that, you know, Prabhuji explained that how wives had heard was like these women used to keep coming and going, so, you know, they would keep hearing about Krishna's pastimes, and then they would keep talking about those among themselves. So that's how they had developed love for Krishna and Balaram.
It's also interesting to note how they came to hear from the Kulindas and the Balan makers and people, because they were open-hearted. They weren't so ritualistic or caught up in their designations as their husbands. So they're prepared to listen to these simple forest dwellers and not hear from them about Krishna. Their husbands wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
You know, who are you? You belong in the forest. Just give me your flowers and go. You know, it would have been like that. But the wives, they're open-hearted. They wanted to hear. They're quite happy to have relationship with anybody, basically. That's sweet. Thank you for bringing it out. That's
a
nice point. Any other thoughts?
And in the end, the brahmanas, they can appreciate that their wives are right, but they still cannot practice.
And, you know, they're basically fearful of Kamsa. They want to go and see Krishna.
So it's not like pure devotion, because pure devotion would make you...
They're fearful.
Well, would it have been necessary for them to go? I mean, unless Krishna asks for something, or they would have had any seva on them?
No, they did, because there was a spontaneous feeling that we should go and see Krishna. That came up in their hearts. But then fear came up in their hearts and answers of that. And they thought, well, what if Krishna, you know, comes as spies, see us? If Kamsa finds out about that, us seeing Krishna, then there'd be big trouble for us. And then they didn't go.
But just interesting, because these women have a probably more difficult situation.
Yes.
Very much so.
Because even socially, you know, it's not really acceptable that you go without the permission of your husbands.
Especially in the middle of the yagya, they're part of the yagya.
And they still went. And these people are considering all kind of things.
I said it first.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Let's see if we can go up with some meter on this. Shinarad said, as Balaram and the gopis intently played, all the cows, hungry for more grass, went far into the forest. When, to bring them back, the Gopa boys went into the Munchatabi forest, a great forest fire, like the fire at the annihilation of the universe, suddenly flared up. Followed by the cows and calling out, "Save us! Save us!" the frightened Gopas took shelter of Krishna and Balaram. Seeing his friends were afraid of the fire, Krishna, the master of all yogic powers, said to them, "Close your eyes, don't be afraid." As the gopis closed their eyes and the demigods looked on, Krishna drank up that terrifying fire. After drinking up the great fire, Lord Krishna took the cows and gopis to a beautiful Ashok forest on the Jamuna's farthest shore. Tormented with hunger, the gopas, respectfully folding their hands, said to Krishna and Balaram, "O Lord, we are tormented with hunger." Lord Krishna then sent them to a place where an Angiras Yagya was being performed. The boys went to the Yagya, bowed down before the performers of the Yagya, and spoke many sweet words. The gopa said, "Herding the cows in the company of Balaram and many gopa boys, Sri Krishna, the prince of Braj, who is more handsome than Kamadev, is now very hungry. O Brahmanas, please give some food to him and his companions." Sri Narad said, "Although they heard those words, the Brahmanas did not say anything in reply." Giving up hope, the gopas returned and told all this to Krishna and Balaram. The gopas said, "You are the powerful ruler in the circle of Braj. In Sri Gokul and in Nandapur, you have the right to punish others. In this land of Mathura, you are glorious and powerful like the blazing sun. There is not severe punishment enough that you can give these people." Sri Narad said, "Lord Krishna sent them again, this time to the Brahmanas' wives. Arriving at the place of the Yagya, the gopas sent by Krishna bowed down before the Brahmanas' wives and respectfully folding their hands spoke. The gopas said, "Herding the cows in the company of Balaram and many gopa boys, Sri Krishna, the prince of Braj, is now hungry. O ladies, please give us some food to him and his companions." Sri Narad said, "When they heard that Krishna had come, the Brahmana women became very eager to see him. Taking different kinds of food in many containers and not thinking of how they may be criticized for their actions, they all went to Krishna in the beautiful Ashok forest by the Jamuna shore. When they saw Lord Krishna's wonderful form, which was just as they'd heard it described, they became filled with bliss. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "O Brahmanis, you are all very fortunate to have come here to see me now. Now, without any fear, please return to your homes. After attaining the result of this yagya, your pure-hearted Brahmana husbands will go, by your spiritual power, to the supreme abode of Kolok, which is beyond the world of matter." Sri Narad said, "All the women offered their respectful obeisances to Lord Krishna and returned to the circle of the yagya. When they saw their wives, the Brahmanas rebuked themselves. Although they also yearned to see Lord Krishna, out of fear of Kamsa, they did not go." So, very interesting little insight that we're given here. I also wanted to read something from Gopal Champu. Jiva Goswami also has his own way of presenting these leelas. And we'd like to share it with you. Understanding that Krishna was hungry, his friends expressed a strong desire to eat. Krishna had left far behind the tall trees bearing fruit. The lunch that Yashoda usually sent at noon did not arrive. They all understood Krishna's desire and began thinking of the lack of food. Krishna spoke with a smile. "At that place, in that Ashok tree forest, without a visible pathway, there are no fruits to eat. Where will you obtain food? If you have hunger pain, go carefully, straight on this path, and you will see many sacrificial arenas, which are actually close by, but which appear far away because of the winding course of the Jamuna. Go north of Mathura, which lies to the south. Going there, beg food for me and Balaram from those Brahmanas skillful at rituals. But keep in mind the teaching that the beggar should always be tolerant." Some of the friends went, and Krishna remained in a huge cottage near the river so that he could see them when they returned. They went to that place filled with the aroma of ghee, streams of smoke, chanting of Yajurveda, white cottages and the coming and going of Brahmanas. They offered respects and remained standing with folded hands, though the Brahmanas did not acknowledge them. Recognizing them only as cowherds, the Brahmanas ascended the mountain of pride and stared at the boys with stern glances. The friends, knowing that Krishna was thin from hunger, spontaneously made their request anyway. The boys requested food at the sacrifice like beggars, and with logic established the meaning of the scriptures. Hearing this, the worshipable brahmanas said, "Oh, they are making a point of teaching us brahmanas about our duties out of greed. In doing so, they have skillfully become most talkative. Let it be. They're too eager to receive food without waiting for a charitable offering. Oh, it seems that this place is where Kali has entered. Some people say that Krishna and Balaram are the supreme lords, but how could they be suffering from hunger if that is true?" Glancing at the bewildered boys and understanding that their intelligence had been defeated, Krishna smiled. He said to them, "Those without pride do not execute dharma as proud people do. Though you are not aware of this now, go to the wives of the brahmanas, and then you will see. Like you, the wives are endowed with a wealth of effort to achieve only prem for me. They drink water only after 2 days, only because they want to see me. And after 3 days, they eat only a few morsels of food." The boy spoke in astonishment. "Oh, Krishna, is that true?" Krishna said, "Certainly." In astonishment, they said, "This is wonderful." After Krishna had spoken, the affectionate boys were eager to go and see the wives immediately. Krishna, with longing in his voice, said, "Please ask them for food for me and my older brother." Eagerly, the boys went to the wives' houses. The wives saw them. They understood that the boys were Krishna's representatives. Then the boys asked for some food. How could the wives refuse? The boys did not mention which food was suitable or unsuitable to bring, and so the wives quickly brought all the vessels of food to Krishna. Putting the unlimited boys in front, the wives, placing the food vessels on their head, went to Krishna. With anxiety at every step, they uttered, "How much further? How much further before we see Krishna?" Krishna was wandering blissfully with his friends in an Ashok forest on the bank of the Yamuna. Soon the wives saw him and thought, "The object of our meditation has become visible to our eyes today." Seeing him, the wives' bodies erupted in goosebumps. While the wives remained standing with the food containers on their heads, Krishna, knowing their sentiments, said, "Welcome, O most fortunate ladies. Oh, you are carrying very heavy loads. That has made me very embarrassed. Why have you come?" He then said, "What can I do for you?"
"Why have you come?"
In shyness, the brahmanas' wives remained silent. But Krishna knew that they had come to him because of love for him. Still he refused them and said, "O wives of brahmanas, my form does not appear at all times and all places, but it will appear eternal in your hearts. That is the way in which you should be close to me. Quickly go back to your houses and sons and husbands. I will be happy if you do that, for I desire propriety at all times." Hearing this from Krishna, and although he said it very gently, they considered his words intolerable, and suddenly devoid of shyness, they answered, "O Lord, you should not speak in that way, for all people say that you alone are comparable to yourself in terms of mercy. Therefore, please be merciful to us. Please accept us." With lotus eyes, Krishna then spoke in humility by mercifully glancing at them. "O Brahmana women, you should act in a way permitted by the devatas, and which does not create hatred in friends or my followers. Your wives are brahmanas. No one permits that you should be in service to others. One should examine and follow these conventions carefully." Now understanding that it was not proper to remain for a long time near Krishna, and understanding that he was reserved towards them, the women, without much delay, respectfully left. Oh, Krishna quickly gave blessings to these women who were gazing at him. That blessing, revealing to their eyes the black form wearing golden cloth which I had just seen, produced great astonishment. After some time, they returned to their houses. Though seeing joyfully that their pots and houses were now made of jewels, they could not understand how it had happened. Later, the brahmanas, seeing that their houses were full of jewels, remembered that Krishna as an infant had filled the fruit vendor's basket with jewels. They became obedient to the intelligence of their wives and accepted Krishna's position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Meanwhile, serving with his own hand, Krishna fed unlimited cowherd boys, and he also tasted that food with a smile, and praising it spread bliss everywhere. While eating the food endowed with sweet, sour, bitter, and salty taste, Madhu Mangala addressed Krishna, "This well-cooked food obtained by begging is equal to nectar. Things obtained by exchange are called bartered goods. Bartered goods is not like this. Food which comes without begging is called nectar, but nectar foods are not as nectar as this. For even if a particle falls on the ground and gets covered with dust, I would still desire to eat it. You must lock these wives of the brahmanas in a cottage near our hut. We will offer to you and Balaram all the hot and slightly hot foods such as saag, vegetables and sweets which they cook. I will become the best person by eating the best of that food." Krishna said, "Oh glutton, because you are insanely greedy, you have given up all shyness." Or the boy said, "Oh big mouth, as a brahmana, you sit in the sacrificial arena uttering mantras, but are alert only to eating the sacrificial food like a rakshasa. Such are the qualities of this brahmana." As the gathering of friends laughed, they ate. Krishna also became satisfied by eating the love-filled food. He then played on his flute to gather the cows. While discussing various subjects, by glancing back at the cows, he arrived at Braj, extinguished the fire of separation for him, and satisfied the people of Braj with the sweetness of his form. The boys spoke nothing of the incident. They refrained from saying that they had gone to the sacrifice and begged. So I haven't been able to find a reference from the Acharyas why they didn't mention this Leela. Any thoughts you may have about this? What came to my mind is that they're Vaishyas and they've disturbed the Brahmin's yajna. So if they tell this one to Yashoda and Nanda, they're going to get chastised. Yeah. Why did you do that? These are respectable Brahmins. You don't do that in the middle of the yoga. You don't, you just, you know. They would have got chested. That was very sweet. So that we won't tell mom and dad this one.
And also because, you know, Yashoda and all the mothers would feel really miserable that, you know, these people were hungry. They had to go begging for food.
Oh, that's a nice insight. That's sweet.
For a mother, it's very difficult to handle.
That's also very sweet. Yeah. So it's always, you know, like, why do these things happen? Why do they do like that? I know it just brings out more and more sweetness of the Leela. Okay, can we hear from Anandamayi Chakra?
What kind of yogic brahmanas were they? As a worshipper, it's well versed in acting according to the proper time. Similarly, these brahmanas performed the yajnas exactly at the auspicious time of morning and evening. Kshatriyas attained the wealth of victory in battle by repeatedly using their bows. Similarly, the brahmanas have become wealthy by constantly doing yajnas. After examining the yajnashala, the cowherd boys walked slowly forward. Although they smelled the sweet aroma of the sacrificial fire, their stomachs remained empty and dissatisfied. Their bangles and ankle bells jingled sweetly as they bowed respectfully on the ground before the brahmanas. Even the King of Heaven esteemed their austere and renowned brahmanas, who always receive the seat of honor at any festival. As personifications of Vedic knowledge, they exhibited extreme gravity, yet they had deep personal feelings. In deep rumbling voices, the cowherd boys addressed the brahmanas, "O worshipable and cultured ones, please listen to us. We are friends of Balaram and Damodar, coming here as your guests. Balaram, the embodiment of all wonderful transcendental qualities, is just nearby, talking with his younger brother. They sent us to you because you are well-wishers of everyone. As oceans of compassion, you Brahmanas benefit all living entities. You always perform pious activities like digging wells, establishing parks and gardens, and making attractive walkways. Being dear to everyone, you satisfy all living entities by giving them the thing they cherish, namely food. You have become effulgent due to your fame. You are charitable and fixed in Brahman. Since we left home early this morning, we have not eaten anything or taken any rest. We are very tired and hungry from roaming all over with the cows. Balaram and Damodar also feel distress. Although they tolerated it for a short time, now they are anxious to eat something. Therefore, they sent us to you to beg some food because you are the maintainers of the Grahastha Dharma. So please make arrangements to affectionately provide us with plenty of food. Although hearing the boys, those sober Brahmanas remained silent, just like deaf men. Understanding that Brahmanas felt no obligation to give them charity, the boys became morose. They thought that the Brahmanas were treating them like hard-hearted, invalid old men. Though wise and learned in yagyas, why did the Brahmanas ignore the humble request of the cowherd boys? Perhaps it was not their habit to entertain the requests of young children. Maybe they disregarded the boys due to their attachment of sacrificing animals, or due to enmity, foolishness, or insufficient piety, or because they had not received any mercy from the Lord. The boys' faces turned pale from disappointment. Lamenting over their failure, they unhappily returned to Krishna. Upon noticing their condition, Krishna remained equipoised and displayed a mild smile on his peaceful lotus face. The faces of the boys, however, conveyed frustration in their begging attempt. At that time, Krishna thought, those yagi brahmanas are not actually charitable towards others. They simply make a big show with their elaborate fire sacrifices. It seems that the charity does not extend beyond the limits of their own bellies. Although mentally disturbed, the cowherd boys tried to explain the situation to Balaram. They said, O Ram, we have never seen such harshness as we saw today in the eyes of those Brahmanas. They are Yagi Brahmanas in name only. Actually, they are first-class fools because they do not know the real purport of the Vedas. Mentioning your names, we beg foodstuffs, which are pleasing to the soul. What to speak of giving charity? They did not even answer us, which is the minimum response enjoined in the Vedas. But in their own homes, we saw and heard them saying so many things such as, cook this, fry that, let us drink, eat, come, go outside, take this way. We saw those Brahmanas, the crest jewels among the Jnanis, busily engaged inside their houses, eating palatable foods. Outside the houses, many thousands of people milled about. Being angry, we did not bother to go there. Seeing the quality of generosity being so dishonored in the hands of the Brahmanas, we did not want to stay there for a moment. By going to them, we received nothing more than utter humiliation, whereas they enhanced their family prestige by performing a huge yagya. O Krishna, our dear friend, we brought back nothing but the smoke that we momentarily inhaled at the fire sacrifice. Like the Vedic injunctions, all of your instructions are held as crest jewels on our heads. Just as nectar never turns salty, how is it that your infallible words put us into such embarrassment? Krishna smiled mildly and spoke some sweet, pleasing words mixed with cleverness. Oh, you boys, why are you affected by false anger? You should not have such a defiant antagonist mood. It is natural that your minds are disturbed because selfish people like those Brahmanas always cause suffering to others. Finding the faults in others is the habit of common people, but you should not see like this. Being preoccupied with the yagyas, the Brahmana obviously could not attend to you. Listen carefully. You should follow my perfect advice and achieve the desired result. The wives of the Brahmanas are also present in the Yagyashala, but they are embodiments of kindness, compassion and purity. They possess the wealth of having completely surrendered their minds to me. Although they are women, they do not take pride in turning beggars away from their doors. These women do not see anything unfavorable for my service. They immediately feel ecstatic upon hearing my name and viewing my transcendental form. They will happily give you plenty of food to remove your hunger. Besides being adorned in golden ornaments, the wives of Brahmana regularly receive and willingly distribute gold in charity. Although they are Brahmana's wives, instead of sitting on the ground like ordinary women, they sit on golden thrones like queens, with their bodies radiating a splendid luster. Feeling gladness within your hearts, go to their private quarters. In my name, ask for abundant foodstuffs, which will bring you all satisfaction. The wives of the Brahmanas, who are just like desire trees, will definitely gratify your cherished desires. O my friends, take my word as a Vedic injunction, which is dear to you and to them. Go there again and beg for food. Being inspired by Krishna's powerful presentation, the gopas left the garden full of fresh creepers. Riding the waves of pleasure, they quickly returned to the Yagyashala. In a submissive mood, they approached the private chambers of the wives of the hard-hearted Brahmanas. Just as lightning spreads throughout the sky and earth, similarly the boys saw the Brahmanas' wives fully ornamented with the effulgent wealth of prestige. As the lightning and rain in Shravan month become separated from the clouds, similarly the Brahmana's wife had given up sense enjoyment due to separation from Krishna. Although lightning flashes out of a cloud in a harsh way, the Brahmana's wife appeared soft-hearted. Lightning flashes brilliantly for a moment and is then detached from the body of the cloud, but the bodies of the Brahmana's wives always emitted an attractive radiance. As lotuses grow in the water on straight stems, similarly the wives of the Brahmanas spoke in a straightforward way. The wives of the Brahmanas resembled golden creepers of flowing beauty moving here and there, but in separation from Krishna they could not find any pleasure. Even without the night, they exhibited effulgence rivaling the glowing full moon. In the absence of Krishna, however, they always felt unhappy. The wives of Brahmanas existed like the personified flames of a fire. Their saintly qualities derided the fame of Arundhati, the chaste wife of Brahmarishi Vasishtadeva. Somehow, they maintained a joyful state of by the strength of their affection for Krishna, which acted like a celestial herbal medicine to sustain them and burned like the steady flame of an oil lamp. During any ceremony, these beautiful Brahmana ladies always behaved perfectly according to time and place. They displayed the limit of worldly conduct by welcoming their guests with sweet words and serving them first-class food. Due to their love for the Lord, they knew how to act properly in all circumstances. As wives of parental affection, they could not ignore the pleas of hungry children. Tolerating the shouts of their angry husbands, they appeared as the embodiments of forgiveness on the earth. Each one of them exhibited many attractive qualities such as purity of purpose and absolute dedication to the Lord. Their wealth surpassed even that of the heavenly king, Indra, who protects others with his thunderbolt. Upon seeing the Yagyapatnis, the wife immediately said, O magnanimous wives of the greatest Brahmanas, we offer our obeisances to your pinkish lotus feet that are the source of generosity and happiness. We are close friends of Krishna, the personification of all knowledge. Please listen to our humble appeal. That one utterance of Krishna's name resonated within the ears of the Brahmana's wives millions of times over. Startled and astounded, they forgot everything and exclaimed, What kind of enchanting mantra is this? Just as a she-deer becomes helplessly attracted by the sweet flute melodies of a hunter, similarly the Yagyapatnis swooned in ecstasy upon hearing the sound of Krishna's name. The pure-hearted wives of the Brahmanas, who appeared on the earth like the predominating deities of the Upanishads, stopped cooking and looked respectfully at the cowherd boys while fixing their minds in meditation. Inspired by Krishna's reassuring words, the boys smiled pleasantly and completed their request to the ladies. O wives of Brahmanas, we are hungry. we did not take any breakfast and have been playing all day. The prince of Vrindavan, who is the reigning cupid of this world and the object of your worship, sent us to beg food. Krishna is waiting nearby, and his elder brother Balram, who always showers Krishna with joy and shines with power of King Indira. Our dear friend Krishna is known throughout the world, so surely you must have heard about him from the lips of the great devotees. Even as a baby, he made the cruel witch Putna famous by giving her the post of his nurse. As a small boy, he pushed a terrible Trunavar demon into the earth and turned Bakasura into an ugly corpse. He banished the venomous serpent Agasur and banished Kaliya from the Yamuna. What more can we say about his fantastic exploits? The glories of all the demons and devotees in the entire material manifestation cannot compare with a drop in the ocean of Krishna's unlimited nectarian glories. Upon hearing these words, the heart of the ladies immediately melted in ecstatic love. They felt that the great treasure of Krishna's form, which is a constant flow of beautiful nectar, appearing as inconceivable eternal existence, had suddenly manifested before them. The thought of directly meeting Krishna stole the chariots of their minds. Somehow or other, the eternal perfection that they desired for so long was now appearing before them. Drowning in an ocean of bliss, their eyes flooded with tears and their tender creepers like bodies erupted in blissful bumps. Their senses went numb and stopped working. The transformation infused them with new life. This newly acquired good fortune enhanced their beauty. Their bodies displayed a splendid elegance as the intensity of their desire to meet their beloved increased more and more. Nourished by such hankering, the eyes of the Yajnapatnis filled with the form of Krishna. Seeing the increasingly ecstatic condition, the cowherd boys felt perplexed. While looking at each other with astonishment, they said, "Upon hearing our appeal, these respectable ladies went mad with the desire to see Krishna. Their actions are very strange. They are not moving, speaking, or looking at anything. Alas, has some evil planet mesmerized them?" It is not surprising that the Brahmanas treated us rudely and totally ignored us. They did not even acknowledge our arrival or give us anything. But we are amazed that their lotus-eyed wives failed to give us anything. Even after attentively hearing our request and showing us so much love, affection, and intention to serve, who can understand the mentality of the Yajnapatnis? How did their behavior change so radically? Something created a sweet mellow within their minds and made them ecstatic. Their transformation could neither remove the cause nor remove the effect. While the humble cowherd boys talked in this way, the wives of the Brahmanas, although failing to respond verbally, went directly into the huge kitchens, which were thoroughly stocked by their maidservants. On a large plate, they expertly piled up rice, vegetables, and other delicious food, which represented their loving desire to please Krishna. The delectable items include creamy cakes, sweetbreads, chapatis, yogurts, and a complete array of delicacies to lick, chew, drink, and suck. They lovingly prepared foods of six tastes, just as the caves, Kandhar, and gentle wind blowing in Govardhan Hill served the Lord. Similarly, they collected many kinds of root vegetables to please the Lord. Before offering them, they artistically arranged all the fragrant, juicy, delicious, and colorful preparations. Just as a woman beautifies herself by wearing golden ornaments, similarly the varieties of attractive vegetables like shak and shukta embellished the offering. As the minds of the Yajnapatnis enriched with spontaneous bliss, similarly the opulence of the offering increased by adding first-class dals and soups. As a divine weapon released in a battle is invincible, similarly the different varieties of cooked spinach acquired undefeatable tastes and qualities. The ladies scented the offerings with their pure desire to prepare everything with love and devotion. According to their heart's desires, the Yajnapatnis put these foods in golden pots with crystal lids. The pots glittered attractively from the different objects reflected on their crystal lids. The ladies covered the pots with fine white cloth. Ignoring the many people milling about the sacrificial arena, they held the pots on their upraised lotus palms and walked out. The best of ladies appeared like many branched desire trees moving on the earth to satisfy the needy. While walking along, they communicated with each other through eye movements and occasionally turned their lotus faces towards Krishna's friends. The submissive cowherd boys ran ahead showing the way to Krishna. Feeling ecstatic, the cowherd boys spoke in soft, joyful voices to indicate the proper direction. The ladies looked like beautiful lotus flowers wandering over the earth. By carrying pots full of food in their lotus palms, they became as fortunate as the gopis who always associate with Krishna. Refulgent as golden lotuses, the Yagyapatis held the pots and walked with the grandeur of a band of she-elephants. The weight of their excessive love for Krishna appeared like a heavy jewel necklace in their hearts. Anxiety filled their minds due to the heavy weight of their pots, full breasts and hip. The ladies proceeded slowly and steadily towards the Lord of their hearts. Though walking was painful, because they were surrendered souls, they felt no inconvenience while going to Krishna. Due to conflicting moods of transcendental ecstasy, they sometimes ran towards their beloved or stumbled and progressed very slowly. The soft jingling of their waist bells and the runu chunu sound of their ankle bells vibrated sweetly as they moved. After going a short distance, they saw the plants and creepers of Raja bending down in a humble, blissful way. From this, they assumed that Krishna, the ocean of all transcendental qualities, must be nearby. They went mad due to their intense love for the Lord. Suddenly, they saw an effulgence more beautiful than a dense rain cloud, a mound of kajal, and a bouquet of blue lotus flowers combined. Aho! Upon meeting their faces, Krishna's effulgence turned into kajal to surround their eyes and reflect on their hair parts. Touching their necks, his effulgence embraced them as a garland of blue lotus flowers. Krishna's effulgence turned into tamal flowers to wrap around their ears. When Krishna's effulgence touched their breasts, it rested there as a necklace of blue sapphires. Illuminating their bodies, Krishna covered them with the blue dress of his effulgence. With unblinking eyes, the wives of Brahmanas beheld their beloved Shyam before them. Resting his left arm on Subal's shoulder, Krishna looked like a wave in an unlimited ocean of beauty. He playfully twirled a lotus flower in his right hand, while simultaneously spinning the minds of the ladies with loving agitation. He wore a peacock feather on his turban, golden yellow cloth around his body, and a garland of forest flowers and leaves hung from his neck. Sandalwood paste and colored minerals adorned his transcendental body. Krishna released a shower of nectar with his attractive, brilliant, bright smile that was more splendorous than the moonshine. Like someone greeting a desirable guest, the ladies opened the doors of their eyes in ecstasy and welcomed Shyamsundar into their hearts. Although Krishna appeared like a practiced paramour lover, his frivolous behavior charmed their hearts. The ladies considered, "Is he a dramatic dancer about to enact a wonderful pastime? Is he Cupid personified, or is he the embodiment of conjugal love? Is he the personified bliss of love? Is he the very form of pleasurable pastimes?" All these qualities raced through the excited minds of the Yagyapatnis. Due to absorption in thoughts of Krishna, they acted boldly, free from doubts and hesitation. Conquered by love, they lost control of their minds while tasting the mellow of their relationships with the Lord. Having taken complete control of their senses, Krishna entered their hearts, came outside, and again re-entered their hearts. During this experience, the Yagyapatnis thought, "How amazing! Our beloved Shyamsundar is standing before us and simultaneously standing in our hearts." In such a bewildered state, the ladies saw Krishna inside their hearts when they closed their eyes, and upon opening their eyes, they saw the beloved before them. Although satisfied to see Krishna within their hearts, they moved closer to him upon opening their eyes. The wives looked very beautiful, holding the offerings of food in their attractive lotus bud-like hands. Just as a desire tree fulfills the heart's desires, similarly Krishna felt satisfied seeing the beautiful bodies of the ladies, which appeared like glittering vines growing in a celestial pleasure garden. Krishna joyfully addressed those doe-eyed ladies. Oh, my dear ones, did you suffer any inconvenience in coming here? Oh, fortunate ladies, please sit down and make yourselves comfortable. I can see you have great love for me because you have personally bought me foodstuffs. There is no way I can repay you for your wonderful service. May you find complete satisfaction in your love for me and thus relieve me of my debt to you. Krishna's sweet deep voice sounded like rumbling clouds. He soothed the ears of Yajnapatnis with his love-soaked, distinctly pronounced words, which were sweeter than the drops of nectar falling from the autumn moon. The wives of the Brahmanas thought they had attained the pinnacle of fortune just by hearing him. Taking Krishna's thought, the aperture of their lotus eyes, they embraced him within their hearts. Melting in rapturous joy, they relinquished all fears and anxieties. With their creeper-like hands, those fortunate ladies offered fragrant flowers of their affection to worship their beloved. Krishna enchanted the minds of the Brahmin wives by saturating them with spiritual bliss and completely removed the painful fire of separation. Krishna continued speaking, "You should return to your husbands and finish the sacrifice. I am pleased by persons who worship me in my form as the enjoyer of sacrifices." Although Krishna's splendid face glowed like the full moon, instead of pouring out heavenly nectar, he delivered bitter poison in the form of unpalatable words. The frustration of the Brahmana's wives' long-awaited desires drained all the color from their bodies. Their minds had become fully attached to Krishna by repeatedly hearing about him from the lips of the Rajvasis. Upon their arrival and initial meeting with Krishna, he encouraged their blossoming desires by saying, "Come and sit down." Then, a few minutes later, he destroyed the flourishing creeper of their desires and made them miserable. Their faces turned pale and cheerless due to being completely ignored, and unbearable pain supplanted the joy they previously felt. Their hearts severely hurt. Tears gushed out of their closed eyes, just as a demigoddess does not cast a shadow. Similarly, these grief-stricken ladies no longer flash their brilliant effulgence. Just as the light in an oil lamp diminishes with the exhaustion of the fuel, similarly the natural glow of the Brahmana ladies eventually decreased to nil. Giving up their shyness, the wives appealed to Krishna with choked voice. "O Almighty One, you are the dearest one to all living entities. Please do not speak such cruel words that pierce the core of our hearts like a thunderbolt. Please listen attentively and do not deprive us the pleasure of seeing you. For if you do, we will surely die." "How could such a thing happen? Alas, does a river rushing out of a mountain peak turn back and take shelter inside the mountain? Of course not, rather it flows naturally to the ocean, which remains neutral and unaffected. You are everything for those who have nothing in this world. O Murari, we have no one else in this world but you. Therefore we can no longer find any pleasure in returning home. In dense darkness, one may make a mistake and go in the wrong direction, but by the power of his piety, he may come to the right path. Similarly, if without any endeavor a blind man attains divine vision, he will not reject that fortune. Alas, no doubt you are learned in ethics and morality, but these words of yours are devoid of love and affection. Until now we have maintained our lives solely by hearing your name and fame. You emanate the beauty, splendor, and sweetness of a thousand Cupid. But where is your sweetness now? O Damodar, although you are proud, please listen to us for a few moments. You have promised to never reject anyone who serves you, and once says, "O Lord, from today on I am yours." Now please keep your promise. We have given up the dark cave of household life, which is nothing but a bitter path full of thorns of hard work. Now please accept us as your maid servants. Our husbands, fathers, sons, brothers, relatives and friends will no longer take us back. They will reject us and laugh at us. Even the sinful people will criticize us. But despite all of this, we offer our bodies in service of your lotus feet. Therefore, O Lord, we humbly beg you to please show us your compassion. Please take control of the chariots of our minds and quickly grant our cherished desire. O compassionate one, we are fully surrendered souls, so please accept us. Intoxicate us with the shower of your nectarian association. On our heads and breasts, we respectfully hold the fragrant flowers which you neglectfully kick away with your lotus feet. Until now, the Yajnapatnis had carefully concealed their love for Krishna within their hearts. Now their bodies, covered with palms of ecstatic delight, clearly revealed their intense attachment to the Lord. The face of Damodar gleamed attractively like the soothing rays of full moon. His leaf-like lips bathed in a sweet smile, and his white teeth shone like a slightly reddish hue resembling pomegranate seeds. After hearing the pleasing praise of the Yajnapatnis, Krishna said, "Listen attentively as I fill your ears with the truth. Such stubborn behavior does not befit you. You should understand that a self-controlled person who surrenders to the scriptures and hears about me, chants my name and glories, and meditates on my form can very easily bring me under his control. Such perfection is not achieved by physical proximity to me. O upholders of truth, please therefore return to your homes and meditate on me. By this practice, you will get free from material bondage and attain me, the friend and Lord of all creation. Actually, in this birth, as the wives of Brahmanas, it will not be beneficial for you to physically associate with me, a member of the Vaishya community. It will be better for you to think of me within your minds. I will also think of you and firmly embrace you there. Please go home and do not be in anxiety about your relatives. Do not worry. Your husbands will not be inimical towards you. Indeed, your husbands, children and relatives are dear to you because I am residing within them in my expanded form as the Paramatma. Only one who has been rejected by me will be envious of a person who has offered his heart to me, the form of the Absolute Truth." The ladies drank the nectar of Krishna's words with the cups of their ears. In this way, Krishna showed his expertise in presenting arguments from different points of view. The Yajnapatnis appreciated his reasonable words and felt great joy within their hearts. Seeing this as Krishna's mercy, they fixed their minds on him and eagerly took his handsome form into their hearts. Driven by Cupid, they disregarded Krishna's contradictory behavior and relished the splendid beauty of his wonderful transcendental form. Though perspiring and shedding tears of joy, the doe-eyed ladies somehow managed to return home.